I genuinely actually was there just to engage them in philosophical conversation. You know, I wasn't there to find out secrets to tell to the governor. I wasn't there to correct their offending behaviour. I wasn't there to make any kind of judgment on them.
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
So today's guest is Kirstine Shifris, who we're delighted to welcome onto the podcast. Kirstine is the author of Philosophy Behind Bars. And Kirstine, it's really nice to have you here. Perhaps if you could tell us a bit about your history and who you are, what you do to get us started.
Yes, of course. Thank you very much for having me on the podcast. I've listened to quite a few of them and I think they're great. So it's great to be on the programme. So my current position, I've just started a new role, which means I've got two jobs at the same time, both of which are part-time. So I work for the Policy Evaluation and Research Unit at Manchester Metropolitan University, and I've been there for about 5.5 years now. And I've just gone down to 2 days a week so I can take up a role working at a new sort of youth justice charity based in London that's called Shift UK, where I'll be heading up their research and evaluation work. Prior to this, the work that we're talking about today was sort of based on my PhD, which was at the Institute of Criminology at Cambridge University. So various different institutions going on there, but yeah.
Delighted to have you here.
Thanks.
Hi, Kirstine. It's really good to meet you today. So to begin, can you tell us how you understand philosophy and how did you come to be philosophizing in prisons?
So the definition of what philosophy is one of those things that you could write a whole book on in its own right. My perspective in this work on what philosophy is about engaging with people in sort of collaborative conversation to explore ideas. Basically, the kind of motive is to try and understand the world better. And for those of you in the therapeutic world, which I know you two both come from, it stems from the Socratic school, this notion of Socratic questioning, Socratic dialogue, and this idea of conversation and dialogue being at the center of it. Of course, there's other things that you can do, like study great texts in depth and analyze them and all of that kind of thing, and that has its place, but that's very much not what I'm experienced or know much about. This is more about dialogue. In terms of how I came to do it, I ended up kind of coming full circle in my kind of career trajectory. In some ways, I started off doing a maths and philosophy degree at Sheffield University, ultimately ended up with just a maths degree, dropped the philosophy after a couple of years, and became a maths teacher for a while. But whilst I was a teacher, I trained in a programme called Philosophy for Children. And I worked in various secondary schools and I kind of ran philosophy clubs and after school clubs at lunchtime and things like that. And it's all based on dialogue and conversation. And then I decided that I was interested in prison education and went to Cambridge University to do a master's. And I was fortunate enough to get Alison Liebling as my supervisor, and I mentioned to her in passing, she just asked me what my background was, and I mentioned, oh, I taught philosophy classes in schools, and it was her suggestion, why don't you do that in prisons? And I kind of went, all right then, and ended up doing that, and then got a PhD to do it and spend a significant sort of period of time teaching in prison. So that's kind of the trajectory from maths teacher to criminologist.
Great, thanks very much for that. So just to contextualize it a bit, can you tell us a bit about education in prisons? How does that work and how did you fit in?
So education in prisons is interesting compared to other kind of programming in prisons. As a rule, the education department is sort of delivered by an external partner, I suppose, is one way of calling it. But it's usually that whilst they work in the prison, it's usually run by some kind of adult educational college that usually also runs some kind of adult educational college outside of the prison system. So Novus is one of the largest of those. There's also Milton Keynes College, and there's probably a couple of others that I can't think of off the top of my head. So there is this quite interesting inside outside type aspect to the way education is run in prisons. In most institutions, although this can vary, there is a dedicated education department within the prison that is a physically different space. And within that, there's often a small library. Sometimes there's also another library elsewhere. And there's classrooms, often a food tech classroom, almost always an art classroom, which seems to be the class that survives all of the cuts and everything. They always carry on with art. Lots of education in prison is primarily focused on sort of basic literacy and numeracy. Again, kind of fitting that deficits model, the idea that people in prison often have low literacy and numeracy. It's not quite true that there is actually, there are lots of people with literacy, low literacy and numeracy levels, but there's also quite a lot of people with higher skills than that. So there's these sort of standardised courses that kind of feed into workshops and vocational qualifications. And then there's also other things like Open University, or there might be external programmes going on where there's a lot of them in the maximum security prisons. I often find things like writers in residence might be there. At one of the prisons I worked at, I had a writer in residence. And there are things like chess clubs and sometimes reading groups going on, but they tend to be a bit ad hoc. The kind of bread and butter tends to be literacy and numeracy in the prison system.
Thank you. I mean, when I worked in Gartry and Grindon, actually, it always seemed to me that the education department was a bit separate, a bit cut mm-hmm. off from the rest of the prison activities. Did you find that?
It's definitely separate. Interesting use of word cut off. I think that varies on the prison. And I think there's positives and negatives to the separation of education. One thing that's quite interesting about education in prisons is that because they're employed separately, because they're different, they tend to have a different demeanour with the men or the women in the prison. They tend to call them by their first names, for example. They tend to talk to them only about their education. A lot of teachers don't even know what the prisoners are in for. They don't know what their index offences are. They might find out in passing, but they tend not to take an interest. And that kind of separation often means that the prisoners themselves see education quite differently. They see them as allies as opposed to people who are there to sort of talk to them about their offences. So it's sort of the place where they can grow and develop and learn. But at the same time, you're right, sometimes there is this separation where it's not always sort of joined up, and that it can be kind of like almost an afterthought to what's going on. It's definitely not central to everything that the prison's doing. But it does vary. That varies massively on the prison and what's going on in the prison, really.
Thank you. That's an interesting point you make about how some prisoners might see education as being allies, as distinct from, I suppose, some of the other members of staff. So do you think then that education might have some advantages over therapy in enabling growth?
So the advantages are, I'm not sure I'd quite go that far. Like, it does something different. I think it can enable growth. I mean, really, it depends on what the therapy is doing. I think in the criminal justice system, the simple answer to that question is yes. But specifically, I'm thinking about that in terms of how therapy is often done in the criminal justice system, where there is this focus, as we know, on risk and deficits. And often what happens in a therapeutic community in the criminal justice system or in even just offender behaviour programmes, even the name offender behaviour programmes, you know, you're basically saying to people, okay, so you're sat in this room, you're here because you're an offender and we've got to deal with your offending behaviour, and this is what you are and this is what we're going to do with you, offending behaviour. And instead, sometimes you just think, well, what about saying to people, right, you're a human being and there's some problematic behaviours, fine, but there's also a bunch of other stuff that we could work on. And I think that's where this difference comes in, with education, and certainly in my philosophy classes, there was this recognition that I was turning up and saying, okay, I'm a human being and you're a human being. Let's just do education for education's sake. Let's just learn and improve. And you can build on people's strengths. So the sort of specifics of your question about it being more, have advantages over therapy, specifically for growth, I think it has to, like it does, because of the fact it allows for growth and doesn't constantly involve looking backwards and focusing on people's deficits. It's not filling gaps, it's building on strengths and giving people something really positive to work towards.
I was just thinking that highlight, I suppose that highlights a difference actually in terms of an awful lot of what is offered in prison is offered as a program. It's called courses, and actually doesn't look anything like therapy as we would understand therapy. And I think there are attempts to offer things that are more akin to therapy within prison, as in their therapeutic communities and Defence Services treatment programme, for instance. But an awful lot of what happens is I think there is a lack of clarity of what therapy means, which therapy fundamentally should be about growth, shouldn't it? And maybe education offers that in a much clearer way than some of what's offered by psychology within prisons.
Yeah, I think there's a complex relationship between therapy and the criminal justice system that I'm kind of working on another project around CBT at the moment that is looking at that. I mean, I wonder whether it's ever possible to do therapy in a kind of traditional or in the way that it's supposed to be intended when there's like aren't people supposed to come to therapy so for themselves, when actually they're often mandated to come in the criminal justice system? And if you're mandated to come for in order to work on stuff that's not about yourself, but about, you know, society's got an issue with some of your behaviours, so we're going to make you go to this therapy. I feel like there's a lot of immediate problems in the therapeutic relationship there, but I'm quite early in any of my thoughts around that. But all of that seems quite complex, that relationship seems quite complicated about what it really is in that environment.
I think it is very complicated, but I think having offered therapy in both prisons and secure hospitals, I think it is actually possible to offer something that does resemble something that's more growth focused. So of course risk is part of the person, and actually it's not in the person's well-being interests to be committing further offences. I think often the kind of feelings that drive offending behaviour arise from distress, which somehow needs healing from or resolving. So I don't think the two are necessarily incompatible, even though I think it is a very complex relationship, as you say. But anyway, we're drifting away from the philosophy.
I agree with what you're saying there. It's an interesting, it needs more discussion and thought, I think, that relationship actually quite a lot.
I think also the therapeutic communities in prisons require people to come at their own will. But of course there is often a great deal of covert pressure upon individuals. So a lot of the initial stages of being in a TC, and I think at the Fens also at Whitemore, is enabling people time to develop sufficient trust really to begin their therapy. And that may be quite a considerable stretch of time, actually. I don't know what you think, Naomi.
Absolutely. I think, it would take up to 12 months, I think, to really foster a relationship that felt where there was enough trust there to be able to pursue things. And of course, I should also say as well that the treatment at the Fens is changing much more to a much more cognitive approach at the moment. So I'm talking about the historical treatment that was available.
Okay, that was very interesting. But can you tell us a bit about how you carried out your research and where you did it?
Yes, yeah, well, that sort of ties into what we were just talking about. So my research involved teaching philosophy at two prisons primarily. One was Grendon, which is a therapeutic community, full therapeutic community, and the other was at Full Sutton prison in the north of England. I'm going to say as well that I'll use the word pronoun, the pronoun he throughout this, because I have only worked in men's prisons, and all of the research that I've done, both in pilots and follow-ups and various things, have always been with men. I think I've only been into a woman's prison once for a day. But these two prisons, so basically my research is kind of what I would describe as an ethnographically led study into philosophy education in prisons, or philosophical conversation in prisons, you might want to call it. It involved me taking on a dual role. So I was both a teacher and a researcher at the same time in each of the prisons. I also did some pilot work. So there are some established philosophy classes in prisons, specifically in Scotland. And I did some pilot interviews with some people in those classes up in Lomas prison, and with the teacher, Nikki Cameron, there as a kind of preparation for my own delivery in England. There's not, at the time, there was no research really into the use of philosophy education in prisons and with people in prison. So this was very exploratory, it was very open. And kind of my research question was basically like, what relevance does philosophical conversation have to the lives of people who are living in the prison system? And it involved pre-participation interviews. It involved delivering 12 weeks of philosophy, because of the way education works and movement works in prison. Each philosophy class was sort of about 3 hours long. So quite a significant amount of sitting in a room with some guys talking about philosophy. Throughout that, I engaged in sort of informal interviews and did conversations both with staff and the people in my classroom. I spent time in the prison, sort of being a teacher, sitting in the staff rooms, going to the wings, chatting to the guys, asking them for feedback. I asked them to fill out feedback forms. I took copious amounts of fieldwork notes. Not during my delivery, whilst I was delivering the sessions, I just was a teacher. And afterwards, I took lots of notes about what happened and how I was feeling and what went on. And I triangulated that by trying to talk to the men throughout. And then afterwards, I did one sort of big formal post-participation interview with the participants as well. So that's where all of my data came from. And what I ended up with is quite a very clear kind of narrative about what happened in the philosophy classroom and this kind of 12-week journey that we went on, and that involved talking about trust and well-being and relationships. But the other point to make as well is that because of the two prisons that I worked in, it ended up being about, or it was about, people who were spending very significant proportions of their life in prison. So this is why the focus ended up being on growth and development, because the exploration ended up being about, well, what does it mean to be a human being, and what does it mean to grow and develop when you're spending a life in these institutions? And we're talking about, I think the shortest sentence was about 7 or 8 years, but everybody else had life indeterminate sentences or fixed term over 10 years. One guy had already served 39 years. One chap had a minimum of 31 and had served about 4 or 5. And the two prisons offered quite an interesting comparison, because as you said, because Grendon's a therapeutic community, they have to volunteer to have been in it, and often it takes a bit of time to get to that point. Also, it's a category B. Most of them had come from the Cat A high security estate. So basically in Grendon, they were basically similar populations in terms of the crimes that they committed and the offence and the sentences that they were engaged in, but they were at very different points. I mean, Grendon, progress had been made. They had managed to make progress. And a lot of them had been in the therapeutic environment for a while, not all of them. And then in Full Sutton, they were very much guys who were often quite early on in their sentences, so they hadn't really made progress. They were quite unsettled, and it meant for very, very different atmosphere as an environment, but really interesting comparison about the role of this type of work in the prison environment.
Thank you. That's a very
colourful description of your research work. It sounds as if you were doing a very complicated task, two tasks of being a teacher and then being a kind of, I don't know, ethnographer afterwards and capturing the experience.
I had the best person probably to guide me through that, which is Alison Liebling, and a lot of her work is ethnographically led and involves hanging around in prisons and trying to understand the atmosphere. I very much enjoyed that part of it though, because it felt like, I think Tony Bottoms was my internal examiner for my PhD, and one of the first things he said to me during my viva was, you've done something quite unusual with your PhD because you've actually done something. And what he meant was I'd gone and actually taught for a time in a prison. I'm really pleased I did that. I really enjoyed it, but it was quite a difficult thing to do, to try and separate it out. And I had to be very systematic in my data collection and as objective as possible. And then I also had to do that thing that we talk about in research, or qualitative, in-depth qualitative research, which is sort of reflection on who we are. And there's a bit in my PhD and in the appendices of the book, I think I popped it in there, that kind of reflects on who I am as a person. Because the fact that I was, this was 5 or 6 years ago now that I did it, but the fact that I was a young female going into a prison meant that the conversation went in a certain way. So first of all, a lot of the guys would often think I was a psychologist. That was quite off common. And that's not always a good thing in the prison. That means I had to overcome some preconceived ideas about what I was there for. But also just in terms of what we talked about, like the fact that I engaged them on certain topics. They were often interested in women's issues. They often wanted to ask me about women's issues. I think that they wouldn't necessarily have asked a man. So in order to really analyse my data and my findings, I had to really embrace like my own biases. Like, why did I pick these topics to focus on? What was I interested in? How did I shape the findings and outcomes of the research? So yeah, it was a really interesting process to go through.
I think though it's also really nice that you gave something to the prisoners, because I think quite often people come and do research and there's lots of interviewing and taking information away, which doesn't necessarily bring any tangible benefit to those individuals that participate in the research. Whereas I think what you were doing gave something that enriched the lives of all the participants that were there. And I you know, it's a shame we don't see more of that kind of research where people actually get a gift in return for their participation in the research.
Yeah, it's really interesting as well, because they also enriched my life. I learned a lot by spending time with them, and it's really interesting because it meant I spent a really long time sitting and talking quite deep questions with people in prison, some of whom had committed some like very, very serious crimes that can be quite difficult for people to sort of sit with, really quite hard for you to think about. But I just sat with them and I talked to them about, you know, what does it mean to be a human being? What is identity? What's a good society look like? How do we decide how to behave? What is morality? All of these kinds of bigger questions. And, you know, with some of them, I probably spent, if we talk about 12 weeks, you know, 2-3 hours a week, you know, I spent 20-30 hours engaging in really deep philosophical conversation with some of them. So I really got to know them, and they got to know me as well, actually. We got to know each other, and then that's sort of how I realised the value of that and what you can get out of it in the end if you spend that time with them. Yeah, I enjoyed that part of it.
Great, thank you very much. I was just thinking when you mentioned earlier on your book that we probably hadn't mentioned the title of your book. It's Philosophy Behind Bars, Growth and Development in Prison. And is it published already?
Yes, it's published with Bristol University Press. And I think it's I think you can get it for about £20 online. I think you can even get it in Waterstones, that one. So it's now out. It's been out for a couple of months.
Great, it's a good read, actually.
Oh, thanks.
So we touched upon trust a moment ago, and trust is one of the themes in your book. Mm-hmm. How did you establish trust with people for whom education, schools, etc., might carry some baggage?
So sort of perseverance, openness, honesty, those kinds of things. I mean, it's interesting as well, I guess, you know, I was running a philosophy class, and there's a certain type of character that will come along to a philosophy class, and these tend to be, you know, this was sort of unashamedly intellectual. And so quite a lot of the guys that came along were already studying in the prison, particularly in Grendon, because they were quite far along in their prison sentences. A lot of them were studying sort of open university degrees and things like that. But I did have quite a few guys as well. That's not true for everyone. I did have quite a few guys who had never engaged in education before in the prison system. And yeah, they just sort of came along and started to engage. And it gave them quite a lot of confidence when they realized that they were able to engage in the conversation alongside all the chaps who were doing their open university degrees, that, you know, they could just engage. And it was quite a nice experience. But the question was, how did I develop trust? I mean, it took a time, really. It took quite a long time. I lent quite heavily on pedagogy in the end, and my own training as a teacher, which, yeah, I went back to some of my philosophy training, my philosophy for children training. And there was a particular point at Full Sutton, I had a particularly complex group that were very charged with specifically religious tensions. I had two chaps who had been convicted under the Terrorism Act, were Muslim guys. I had one chap who converted to Islam whilst in prison. I had another who described himself as a spiritualist, who was sort of old, like had been in and out of prison for many years. And then another guy who was an atheist and very, very vocal about his atheism and his concerns around Islam in the prison system. And then I also had a young Catholic guy, and they were all, their religious identities were very much at the forefront of what, of the way they engaged with their environment. And it was just, they did not trust each other. They did not like each other. They certainly didn't trust me at all. They didn't, some of them didn't really understand the fact that I'm not religious, and I found it quite, what's the word? I didn't really expect to end up in the middle of this very religious, like this very tense religious kind of battle almost between them. And in order to kind of, so I ended up going away, and some of them, the first few sessions were just really difficult to manage. They were really like not really talking to me. They were really going at each other, and they weren't really engaging in the topic properly. I kept on trying to bring them back. One guy walked out and never came back. It was all quite like difficult to engage with. And what I ended up doing was going back and thinking, like, what am I trying to achieve here? Like, what is philosophical conversation? And I like dug out some of my old notes from when I first trained in it and Googled a bunch of stuff on various resources, and was like, okay, what I'm aiming for is collaborative philosophical conversation. And what that means is that we're not sitting here having a debate over whether you should smoke a cigarette in a car with a child, which it was one of the topics that came up. But instead, what we want to say, well, is, okay, if you think it isn't okay to smoke cigarettes in a car with a child, what's the underlying moral principle that you're basing that on? That you shouldn't do harm to somebody else? Is that what it is? And what it helped me do was remember that we're always going back to these underlying bigger philosophical principles, and that my role was to try and guide them back to those points. I wasn't always perfect at doing that, but I did. Yeah, so, but by focusing on that philosophy and maintaining a kind of integrity and offering my own opinion when it was suitable, what they gradually learnt was that I genuinely actually was there just to engage them in philosophical conversation. You know, I wasn't there to find out secrets to tell to the governor, which is what some of them thought I seemed to be doing. I wasn't there to correct their offending behaviour. I wasn't there to make any kind of judgment on them. I just literally wanted to have philosophical conversation with them, and write a PhD about whether they enjoyed it and what it meant to them to have that opportunity. And over time, they got it. It kind of broke. It took about 6 or 7 weeks, and they in the difficult one, it was a bit quicker with the other classes. But they eventually realised, oh, she is just here to talk about philosophy, and they kind of like stopped arguing with me and seemed to engage better.
Sounds like you did really well to get past that potentially explosive first stage.
Yeah, it was quite hard. I had a lot of support from the staff at the prison. That was in Fulcerton, and you know, the staff in the prison were pretty good. You know, I'd come back and be like, oh no, I've really upset this guy, and they're like, don't worry, this happens. And I would sort of try and understand them, and then from my supervisor as well, who helped. And then there's also just like I say, just sort of sheer perseverance, where I you know, and the fact that I'm a trained teacher really helps. Like I've dealt with, you know, I've got behaviour management techniques from working with teenagers, but not that you can't use the same techniques, because these are grown men. These are men who are 20 years older than me with huge life experiences. And I learned that quite quickly, that if I wasn't careful, I would patronise them. And I did do that once, and one guy left and didn't come back. And I went and reflected and thought, what am I doing wrong here? So you have to engage very differently. But there was a sort of like, I guess, a resilience built up just through training that I'm kind of used to, just having to persuade people to engage with education, as opposed to them just sitting down and being ready to learn immediately or ready to engage. But it was also quite, it was what I also had to recognise. So with Fulcerton, I also had to learn that this was quite a kind of, what's the word, discombobulating? Is that the word? But quite a disconcerting experience for them. It isn't common to be able to have a space to genuinely, openly and freely articulate your opinion without it coming back to you at any point, either within the system or from other prisoners or whatever. And they had to learn that this we had to create together a safe space. And it was quite, I think it took them a while to really go, oh, hang on, this really is a safe space where we're allowed to explore different ideas and different ways of thinking. And that I think is quite important. That's when they started using, that's why they explained the experience of being like a little bit of freedom and like to articulate a different side of who they are. So I think that all plays into that notion of trust, really.
Related to that, Kirsteen, I'm curious about whether you faced any challenges in earning the trust of staff, because you talk about establishing kind of like these meaningful conversations where you're talking about really deep issues where people were offered the opportunity to experience you as a human being. And those kind of characteristics can cause fear amongst people that are employed by the prison service, I think. I wondered whether you faced any of those challenges.
No, not so much. I mean, there was one or two moments where, you know, staff might make a sort of slightly negative comment. But really, I just kind of, I got my own keys and trotted into prison and did it. And as a rule, especially because in the long-term prisons, like in Grendon's a sort of different space, isn't it? So, you know, there's a much more open attitude in that prison towards different ways of doing things. So that was fine. And in Fulcerton, you know, they get the fact that what they've got is a population of men who are serving long periods of time and they don't have much to do. And anything that occupies their time a bit, they're kind of happy with. So I didn't really get too much pushback from, generally the prison was pretty open and happy for me to be there. The staff were quite, I didn't really, the uniform staff, I didn't really engage with a huge amount. Fulcerton had an interesting, you know, the staff felt quite separate, and there was a lot, I felt quite watched by the staff. Like the education staff were lovely. I had cups of tea with them and sat, and they were really kind, and the fact that I'm a trained teacher I think helped, because I understood their language and their environment. But the uniform staff often, I felt like they just spent the whole time standing in corners watching what was going on. It felt very kind of almost a bit oppressive, that prison. It was quite a separate, if I was chatting to one of the prisoners, you often felt like a staff member was sort of looking at you, wondering why you were having like a friendly chat with someone. It was quite a, yeah, quite an interesting thing. So I didn't really have much to do with the uniform staff, apart from them searching me when I went in. Mm.
Okay, thank you. And one of the things that seems to characterise prisons is this tendency towards black and white thinking, which of course you're describing engaging in something that's the polar opposite of that. And I think that, you know, that's got something to do with fear and the impact that this has on our brains, where we end up relying on shortcut thinking. How difficult was it to get people to start occupying the grey land in the middle?
Yeah, that was quite interesting. Yeah, that was, and it was a really interesting route to doing, to achieving that. The philosophy really helped them with that kind of nuanced thinking. Gwendyn was a bit easier, I think, because in Gwendyn they spend so much time in therapy, they're quite used to having, because they sit in big circles and do Socratic dialogue for a different purpose, that for them having those slightly more nuanced conversations, they have skills, is what I think I refer to it as, they have skills in open conversation that helped. But even there, they initially started with quite black and white thinking, and then eventually we developed this nuance. And the pedagogy helped. So because the sessions were 3 or 4 hours, or between 2 and 3.5 hours, I staged my philosophical conversations. So I would have like 3 or 4 stages to it. And I actually really enjoyed that way of doing it, because what it did was it drew them through different ideas. And one of the techniques that I used to try and encourage nuanced thinking was I remember doing it for Descartes and Hume, for both sessions, I did 2 sessions, one on Descartes, one on Hume. For both of them, I started off with their perspective on how we know stuff. So for Descartes, I showed them a bunch of optical illusions. And then Descartes' thing was, you know, we shouldn't trust our senses, basically. How do we know stuff? And Hume was an empiricist, so he believed in observation. So both of them started on this real core idea of what is knowledge. And then I led them through this idea, Descartes thought this is what knowledge is, and this is what led him to say that we have this mind-body problem, that a human being is made up of a person and a mind. And then I sort of took them through that. And then, but the very final stage was often quite a sort of strong counter-example to it. But really it was that building up of ways of thinking. And then the next week we did the complete opposite. We did Hume, whose version of what a human being is completely different. He didn't believe in a soul. He thought that we were just, that human beings are a bundle, it's called Hume's bundle theory of the self, that we're just a bundle of experiences. And so by showing them 2 different ways of thinking about it and helping guide them through it, they were able to see and explore just different angles on the same themes. And often I would encourage them, because through the staged process, often I would sort of show them like neat little counter examples that would sort of force them to go to rethink what they just said. And what it helped them do and helped me do was be comfortable with changing your mind. And I think that's quite key. Mm-hmm. If you want to move away from black and white thinking, everybody has to be able to change your mind. You know, in light of new evidence, in light of a new way of thinking, you're allowed to change your mind. And the other thing is, as well, is to be comfortable in then not being an answer. And so one of my introductory session that I always give is the story of Theseus's ship. And it's in the opening chapter of the book, but Theseus's ship is it's a bit like, if people remember Only Fools and Horses, Trigger's broom thing, where he says he's replaced the handle and the head like so many times, and is it still the same broom? But Theseus's ship is an ancient philosophical conundrum that was written down in the 1st century AD by Plutarch. And he wrote in his biographies that they preserved Theseus's ship for generations, to the point where they had replaced when old pieces of the ship needed replacing, they would do so, to the point where every single piece of the ship had been replaced. And the question of the time was it still Theseus's ship? And Plutarch said that apparently half the philosophers of the day said it was not Theseus's ship, and half the philosophers said it was Theseus's ship. And kind of the point of that for these men was that this is a 2,000-year-old problem that no one has come up with a satisfactory answer for. And I've done this session loads of times with lots of different people, and it always takes new directions and there's new ways of thinking about it. And it's that kind of, you have to be comfortable with saying, do you know what, I just don't know. I have no idea, is it thesis shit? I don't know. And understanding that, well, from this angle, yes, it is thesis shit. From this angle, no, it isn't thesis shit. And it's that kind of like being comfortable with changing your mind and not knowing the answer. I think it helps encourage people away from that black and white thinking.
Thank you. I think that's a lovely answer. And I mean, I loved your book. I think it's really beautifully written. Oh, and I also like the way that you weave the various philosophical schools through the book, because my previous encounter really with philosophy was the philosophy of psychology at university, which was a mandatory option, and I absolutely hated. I couldn't understand why I was being expected to contemplate whether this chair could actually be a cake rather than a chair. And I think it's really nice to talk with people that make philosophy have some real world meaning and value to it. And I was curious about which of the philosophers that you spoke about that your participants enjoyed most and why.
They always like thesis issue. The one that the school of philosophy that I find prisoners, or people in prison I should say, relate to the most is Stoicism. So there's a whole school, various different schools of philosophy that are focused on the good life. And we don't mean good as in morally good, we mean good as in the fulfilled, the happy, you know, life. And that was back in the day. I'm not an expert on any of this, but, you know, you have the sort of cynics and the Stoics and the something else's, all of that. But I often did Stoicism with people in prison, and they always came back and said that they were quite stoic. They really related to that. And I think in many ways, like, to survive the prison experience, you do have to be quite stoical, actually. You do have to control your emotions to a certain extent. You do need to, and there's a big difference between suppressing your emotions and controlling them. Those are different ideas. And there's that acceptance as well, because Stoicism is supposed to be about, you know, accepting what you can't change and just focusing on what you can and all of that kind of thing. And I think if you can be quite stoical, that's how you can get on in the prison system, really. So they always enjoyed that one, I think.
Thank you. I'm sure a lot of staff would have related to that as well, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the things you write about is how prisons impact on a person's sense of self. What were your findings in relation to that?
Yes. Yeah, so yeah, particularly in Fulton, but also in Gwendon, I quickly discovered that if I was going to understand what was going on in my philosophy classroom, I needed to understand the prison. And this is where this idea of the person in context came. So kind of one of the mechanisms that I've used to try and frame my analysis of what happened is understanding that what you've got is individuals who are living within a context. I actually found my favourite philosopher to help me understand this was Hannah Arendt, who I also covered. I actually covered her because I just desperately wanted to make sure there were some female philosophers in my philosophy class. And I discovered, so I looked her up and I read some of her stuff. And one of the things that she says is that as a human being, our identities are internally articulated but externally validated. So what she means is there's this constant interaction between the stories that we tell ourselves about who we are and the environments that we're working, that we're engaging in, and the environment feeds back into these stories and us, and we try and express ourselves in the environment that feeds back. And this constant loop is sort of a really good way of helping us think about what the prison environment does when it comes to people's identities. And, you know, prison's such a complex place, and this is where I turned to prison sociology literature, and I went and read a bunch of the sort of classic texts around what prison does and how it makes people feel and the kind of what a prison environment is. And that's, and I also spent time in the prisons trying to understand those specific environments. And basically what my findings are, or what the research tells us is that prison encourages what we might call a survival identity. And the men talk about it. We use often, as prison sociologists, we often use Goffman's what we call dramaturgical metaphor, which is this notion of this front stage and backstage self. So the backstage is when you're relaxed and comfortable and you can kind of be your true self, I suppose some people might call it. And then the front is what you put on in different environments. And it's sort of what's suitable for a different environment. And what we know about a lot of prisons is the front that the prisoners have to, particularly in male prisons, often have to put on is one that is like quite sort of hyper masculine, quite macho, shows no emotion or fear in the face of what's going on, that they can cope, all of this kind of stuff. And the men talked about it in the philosophy classroom. They use the word front, that they'd have to put on a front, they'd have to project a particular persona in order to survive the environment. But I'm using the word survival slightly differently, because there's surviving the environment in terms of sort of physically surviving and psychologically surviving and not having a breakdown. But I'm also interested in how does your sense of self survive through that? If you're constantly in a position where you've got to put up this front, how does your sense of who you are and as a person actually survive that? And in the prison, there isn't many places where you can have a backstage self. So fine, these guys were in cells on their own. These weren't, because they're high security, they weren't sharing cells. So they'd have time in their prison cells on their own where fine, they'd relax, not interacting with anybody. And also prison staff can open the door at any time. You know, they're not really, it can be broken, that backstage sort of safe space can be broken at any moment. So I guess in terms of my own findings, what I kind of learned was that philosophy can provide a safe space. It's not necessarily a place for the backstage self, because there's still a front, but the type of front that they can engage in there is quite different to the one that the rest of the prison provides. There they can be philosophers, they can be educated, they can be there for different reasons, they can drop their kind of labels of prisoner and offender and whatever else that they've got going on and just be philosophers for a time. And what I learned was that was extremely valuable to them. For some of them, particularly the guys who'd been convicted of sexual offences, to have a sort of young woman come in and just talk to them about philosophy on a personal level, like just as human beings, was they were profoundly grateful, which was quite, I didn't expect that. I didn't quite understand how meaningful that would be to just be given this space. And I guess what I would suggest is that we need to maybe find ways of cultivating more spaces like this where they can, because I always think we spend a lot of time working on diverting people away from things and away from behaviours, but we also have to give them space to divert them towards something or to find their own path and to be something else. It's all well and good working on the stuff we don't want them to be, but what about working on the stuff that they might want to move towards? And I think we just don't have enough of that in the prison system at all.
I think that's absolutely true. There isn't enough opportunity to engage as a whole living human being, is there, with health across a number of areas.
Yeah, and express yourself, just be, like, explore who you want to be and try out new identities and just, you know, just be something that isn't the man on the wing, you know, in the cell. Like, yeah, it's a really, I think there are some spaces, I think the chaplaincy can offer some interesting spaces for that. And I think often there's like art classes where they might be able to self-express in a certain way. But there was in the philosophy classroom, there was this dialogic side to it, this conversational side, which is where that kind of notion of reaction comes in. You know, in an art class, you're expressing yourself through drawing and painting, and that's really important and has its place. But there's something about the fact that they were sat in a room and they would give their opinion and someone would respond to it. And they have to learn different behaviours. You get this opportunity to learn how to disagree with people politely, for example, and be comfortable with the fact that just because someone disagrees with you, they're not judging you, they're not saying, you know, it's okay for somebody to disagree with you. They're not saying anything about your fundamental sense of who you are. They just happen to come from a different angle, and that's okay. It's all that kind of like, oh, we can still be friends even if we don't, you know, believe in the same religion or something. Yeah, it's that reaction that I think is really important.
Thank you. That's fascinating. Actually, Kirsten, because I mean, so much of what you've been saying for the past 20 minutes takes me back to, well, particularly community meetings, where you'd be having these similar kinds of discourses, but of course without the kind of philosophical framework, but it's ringing a bell with me. It's very powerful stuff. So you talk a lot about growth in your book. Can you say something about the growth framework that you arrived at towards the end of your book?
So the growth framework that I arrived is very, I get these words mixed up, inductive or deductive. I think it's inductive. I that came completely from my data, and isn't necessarily the kind of next stage for me, I suppose, would be to reach out into look more at sort of things like growth mindsets and things like that. I didn't necessarily engage with that literature at this point. So the framework just came very much from the analysis. So there were sort of four key themes that came out of the data from the interview schedules, and that was well-being, trust, relationships, and open-mindedness. And those were the sort of four things that the participants themselves were telling me they were getting out of these programs. And then the other aspects of it were more about, well, the how. So I'm very interested in, you know, it's all well and good talking about outcomes and activities, but we have to articulate what it is about these activities that is supposedly reaching these outcomes. And for me, that's where that safe space for self-expression was one of the key kind of frameworks for growth. And I'm going to have to remember the other one, something like it was the community environment. There's the self-expression and then the safe space side of things. So it that's how I arrived at it. It was just by trying to explain and shape the connection between what was going on in the classroom with what the men were telling me they were getting out of it, and trying to find a way of articulating how those things link up. Hopefully I've answered that question well. It's quite an interesting question. How did I arrive at a growth framework?
Thank you.
How did prison change you and impact on your identity, Kirstine?
How did prison change me and impact on my identity? Oh, no one's ever asked me that question before. I think, how did it change me? I think it gave me confidence. I think spending a long time in the prison environment, like lots of people who do this research in prisons often will go in and to conduct various interviews, but because I kind of hung out in a prison, you know, I spent 2 days every week in the prison for, 4 or 5 months. And I very much sort of hung around in the staff rooms and things. So it gave me a lot of confidence in my findings and in my process as a researcher. I think in terms of my own understanding of myself, it gave me a much deeper understanding of what it means to be a human being, what it means to be a person, what maybe people need, you know, to grow and develop and we could also ask whether, you know, it is a need for human beings to grow at all, or whether just being still. I think there are some cultures that might disagree with that perspective. That's probably quite a Western way of thinking about, what it means to be a person. But it definitely gave me an insight into understanding that one attribute of a human being is not all that they are, you know, yes, fine, I was working with some people who committed some very, very serious offences, but I also saw they had some really, you know, these weren't immoral people necessarily, like these weren't people who had ways of thinking about things that I fundamentally disagreed with. I mean, some of them would come out with things that I fundamentally disagreed with, and occasionally I'd have a little back and forth with them if they came out with something particularly outrageous. But I think I learned a lot more about the fact that there is more than one dimension to people. I probably have to think about that question a bit more, really. But yeah, I think that's all I can say on it.
No, thank you. That's great. But I suppose related to that, I suppose I was curious about whether it changed your doing this whole piece of research, whether it changed your relationship to philosophy or any of the philosophies that you discussed.
I got the opportunity to kind of learn a bit more about philosophy and do a bit of sort of more wide reading around different philosophers. I was interesting thinking about like moral behavior, and also that we did some stuff about how society should be organized. And it's interesting, it's really interesting to talk to people who are in prison about how society should be organized. So I did it through Plato's Republic and asking them to think about being washed upon a desert island. It's actually a story that I nicked from Peter Warley. He wrote a book called The If Machine, works at the Philosophy Foundation. But it's a kind of nice little route into talking about how society should be organized. And it's really interesting. People in prison come up with some very different answers. The first time I did it in a prison was actually a pilot as part of my master's at a prison in London. And I said, how should we organize? You know, we're all shipwrecked on a desert island. There's 30 or 40 people. What should we do? And they basically started out by saying, well, we should just let people get on with it. Just no rules, let people do whatever they like. And then after a while, they started to realize that you did need some kind of structure to it. And they kind of, what you sometimes see is them kind of come to some realizations about the nature of how society needs to be organized to function. So it gave me some really interesting insights into thinking about things differently. I think my views have been enhanced by it. My ability to explain my own opinions have been enhanced because I've heard such, they come from such a different walk of life to me as well, some of them, and to each other. You know, these are not one homogenous group, that they really have a really nuanced way of thinking about things, and their life experiences are so different that it just, sometimes they would say something, I was just like, I've never even thought about it that way before. One time, I'll stop in a sec, but there's one time in particular, and I keep quoting this guy actually, and we were talking about, I think, equality and life chances, if I can get the story right. And he basically said something like, it was something about equal opportunity and how everybody should have the opportunity, the same start in life. I think I'd said something like, well, shouldn't everybody have the same starting off in the same opportunities? And he said, it's not about people getting the same start, it's about people getting to the same finish line. And I thought it was a really, he turned it on his head, where he sort of said, oh yeah, this isn't just about opportunities, this is also about people being able to actually get to the same quality of life regardless of the different things that happen in their life. And I thought, yeah, I think about that quite a lot, about what that means, about how we should support people with different needs, basically.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Kirsten. It's been really good speaking with you today, and I'm very grateful for that. And I can't resist the temptation to insert a question that's somewhat different from the ones that we've posed to you already, because you sent us a separate paper entitled Provocations, which I think is the beginnings of a project you must be formulating about the place of CBT. And in this, you raise some really challenging questions. They're so challenging and so interesting that I think we need a separate discussion. Mm. But you conclude by quoting Richard Layard, and the quotation is, "What is the biggest single cause of misery in our community? Most people would answer poverty, but they would be wrong," close quotation. What do you think about the terms of right or wrong in this context?
Thank you for that. This is from another project looking at CBT. It's with Shad Maruna actually, and Chris Fox at MMU. And yeah, we're very much at the beginnings of this, but it's interesting, right or wrong. I think he's quoting something out of context there. It's what he's quoting is a bunch of research that suggests that really it's the opposite of what he's saying, and that's that being rich doesn't make you any happier. But this is after your basic needs are met. You know, this is after, like, the fact that, you know, you might have a sort of job that means that you're fed, that you can take your kids to a few after school activities, that you can go on a couple of holidays a year, and you live in a little house. The research shows that you're actually no happier there than you are, no happier if you live in a mansion than you are if you just sort of live a relatively straightforward life. But this is after this is when you're already above the poverty level, I guess, is the point point that we're making. So yeah, that was what, like, I think it's just out of context. Maybe people are wrong in saying that the biggest driver of misery is poverty, but he's definitely quoting something that is not quite right. I think poverty probably plays quite a large part in people's misery. Yeah.
Thanks. Well, we can take a rain check on the rest of the discussion around this issue and maybe come back to you, hopefully in the not too distant future. So we'd like to end our conversations by asking our guests how they maintain their well-being when working in testing and adverse situations. But to be a bit more specific with you, how do you maintain that sense of contemplation in circumstances where many people resort to much more primitive black and white thinking?
I think it can be quite hard when you're working with people who are living their lives in such austere environments. When you're spending so much time with them, it can be quite difficult. I think I try to spend time doing stuff that doesn't have anything to do with the prison system. So I don't watch crime dramas. I don't watch documentaries about prison. I don't engage with conversations about that. I tend to watch stuff that's like cooking programs or something like that. And I go running. I listen to a lot of music. I do a lot of yoga. The kind of normal, I feel like those are kind of like normal answers. And I guess there is also a part of it where I try to maintain a sense of humanity throughout. So I try to remember that, you know, you're working with human beings and this is the life that they live. And we should all remember that, really, that this is about the fact that people are sort of spending long time in prison and we have to understand, well, what that means and whether that's right. But I don't know. Hopefully I've answered your question there. It's an interesting way of thinking about it. I think it can be quite hard to get the prison out of your head, actually, after you've spent quite a lot of time in there. And I think it is something that's quite important to try and make sure that you can keep a separation.
Yeah, no, it can be. I know. I always had a sense, and it was somewhat uncanny, that when I left work, because I was working entirely in B category prison, so a lot of the time shut up, but I always had that weird feeling that as soon as I'd gone out the front gate, the air smelt and tasted differently.
Yeah.
And that kind of helped me recognize the difference and the separation, although of course the thoughts lingered on.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. I think there's something really interesting. The other thing I should say I do is I write notes a lot. The fieldwork note, the downloading of the information into fieldwork notes, either via a dictaphone that you then type up or just sitting writing. Often I put a 5-minute timer or a 10-minute timer and just write like what happened. I think that's quite a, you know, what happened today. I think I find that quite therapeutic, just to download all of the information. And then also that forms the basis of my fieldwork notes, but it was both for myself and for the research.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was absolutely fascinating, Kirsty. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me on the podcast. It's really interesting to be able to talk to you both. Like I say, I've been listening to it throughout lockdown and things. So, yeah, no, it was really, really interesting questions and good to talk to you both.
Yeah, we definitely love to have you back on again when you've got your provocations to talk about.
Yes, yeah, maybe in about 6 months or so, maybe a few months we should be ready. So we'll be back in touch. Yeah, I'd be really, really interested to hear what you think about that, because about CBT and its role in the prison, we're trying to open a conversation. So yeah, that'd be great.
Much needed. Thank you. Really enjoyed that conversation. I think one of the things that's been quite striking for me, actually, as we've been doing this podcast, is the amazing conversations that we've had with philosophers as part of our kind of like journey
of exploration around well-being. So Kirstine isn't the first philosopher that we've featured, and each time we speak to someone from a philosophical background, I come away kind of like feeling really uplifted and nourished by the conversation. I suppose the thing that was really striking for me was all that rich work helping people find ways to have conversations that are complex, that are nuanced, that are respectful of different opinions, and that challenge that need to have a black and white answer to things. And what a rarity it is to find that in prison. And thinking that even when people don't want to sign up for treatment in a therapeutic community or in another kind of like process focused therapeutic regime, that actually there's some real benefits and gains to be had for people's lives if they can be helped to find ways to have these kind of conversations.
Yes, no, I agree with that. And a number of things struck me. The first one I touched upon in the conversation was to do with recognising that the sort of discourse that took place in the community meeting, so that's with 40 to 50 people present, was so similar to the kind of discussions that she was describing from her philosophy presentations. And as she talked, you could begin to see that those discussions had some kind of form which totally linked to the various philosophical models she was describing.
Well, I was just going to add that, because I didn't say this during the conversation with Kirstine herself, but actually what a great book it is, but not just from a sense of being more familiar with the different philosophers and what each of those philosophers has contributed, but actually some really lovely observations about prison life within Kirstine's book, and some of the nuances of some of the, you know, small observations about what life feels like for people in prison that I think get conveyed in quite a visceral way that isn't always there in research.
True. So the other things that came across to me were that there's an absence of safe places for detained people to think and to talk, particularly to talk freely. So you either wear the mask or you place yourself at risk. Mm. And I thought the idea that she was providing a sort of haven for that to take place was really powerful. And the final thing was to do really with what she was describing as the skills of being a teacher. So she was describing herself as a pedagogue, really, and it made me realise how much pressure I've experienced over the years to give seminars, to lead sessions, to do teaching, really, when I essentially have no skill at all in that area. What a struggle it's been, and how it's important to recognise that there's considerable skills to be developed.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage lockeduplives.com and our Twitter account Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.